Hey there, this is Sarah, the host of Trending Globally.
And this is Dan, Trending Globally's producer.
And we just wanted to say, if you like what you hear, you can get more conversations just like this by subscribing to Trending Globally on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
And if you've already subscribed, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps others find us.
All right, enjoy the show. From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Sarah Baldwin. As the coronavirus spreads around the globe, it's highlighting how international development affects the well-being of us all. So in this episode, I talked with someone who's been a leader for decades in rethinking how we do international development, Watson Senior Fellow Brian Atwood. Brian's worked with multiple U.S. presidents, including as the head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, also known as USAID, during the Clinton administration. As Brian makes clear, the world is changing faster than many of our institutions can handle.
When the UN was created in 1945, there were about 2.2 billion people on the face of the earth, and now we have 7.5 billion. The world just wasn't ready for that.
As you'll hear, we recorded this interview right as the coronavirus was becoming a crisis, so most of our conversation wasn't actually focused on that. But listening back, we felt like Brian's experience and perspective are more relevant now than ever. We started by discussing something called the UN's Millennium Development Goals, which Brian helped to define back in 2001. They included raising people out of extreme poverty and decreasing infant mortality with a deadline of 2015. That year, a second, more wide-ranging group of goals was created with the hope of meeting them by 2030. Before we got to the newer goals, I asked Brian, how did we do the first time around?
How did we do? We did pretty well on the goal that no one thought would work, which was to eliminate extreme poverty, which was less than a dollar a day. And everyone said, well, there's no other UN goal that says this. How could this possibly happen? Well, mainly because of what happened in China, we were able to achieve that goal. No question about that.
And when you say what happened in China, you mean China's growth and development?
China's growth and development and their investments internally helped the world achieve a goal that no one thought we could achieve. And we made progress on a lot of the other goals. Certainly the goals of infant mortality rates have gone down. More kids are in school. We're not necessarily seeing the achievements gaps being closed, but at least people are in school and more than ever. And each of these goals, these social goals in particular, are extraordinarily important in preventing the kind of crises that we've been seeing. Mm-hmm. More investment is needed, and we've increased slightly about the inflation rate over time. But when you think about overall development aid, it's only $200 billion maybe. And the needs are far greater than that.
Why do you think there are twice as many articulated goals this time around? Is that because we learned to be more nuanced after the first set of goals, or because there are more problems, or we're more ambitious?
I think it's a combination of both, and the process this time was not as contained as it was the first time. I mean, a few people, including myself, were involved in writing the initial eight goals. And we looked at our own mission, our own institutions, and basically extrapolated from that and said these should be the goals for the world. This time, the UN took over and went to every region and asked them what their goals should be. And so then I think some academics got involved and said, well, look, you know, we need to make sure that we have the evaluation techniques to figure out whether we're succeeding. And whenever academics get involved, you get more goals and more targets and a more sophisticated approach to it all. So now we have something like 17 and several sub-goals that I think are very useful. They become not just goals for the developing world, but goals for all of us. And that, again, makes it much more acceptable to the United Nations. It's not a question of developing nations going off in the group of 88 or whatever they call it, 77. and then the developed countries. We're in this together. So
I want to ask you about one in particular, one of the goals: peace, justice, and strong institutions. And I think those words put together are really interesting. And I imagine that you might have something to say about the relationship among those three things.
Well, I once did a paper called The Relationship of Development to Violent Conflict. And it is, I found it interesting. This was done maybe 10 years ago. There was very little literature on that. The literature that existed was written by sociologists looking at inner cities in the United States. In particular, the one that I recall was Chicago inner city and the amount of violence. And it came down to the question of social cohesion and what did people think about community. And was it a peaceful community, or if in the case where social efficacy, as it was called by the sociologists, broke down, it became an issue of people forming gangs. And we're seeing this all over the world now. They are down and out. They don't have any, they don't have an education. They don't have health care. They don't have any of those things. And so they find their affinity in their small gangs, and it becomes violent at that point. How does development relate to national interest and security? I think people are beginning to understand that if social efficacy breaks down, communities don't exist, there's no social cohesion, then you have chaos and you have violence.
Mm-hmm. And so the institutions are education, healthcare system, public health system.
Yes, and institutions like justice ministries and things like that that actually carry out a rule of law.
Accountable
and
governments.
And are seen as fair and even to raise resources fairly, have tax systems at work so that the needs of society can be met.
Back in 1985, you were the founding president of the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. Can you talk about what that entity aimed to do, and were you part of the founding of it? And what did it aim to do, and what made you see the need?
When we started, we had five people, so I guess I was the founder of it all. It comes ironically from a speech that Ronald Reagan gave at Westminster, advocating that democracy should be helping other democracies that are fragile and new. And they had no idea in the Reagan administration how to do this. And two advocates of human rights, Don Frazier, the congressman from Minnesota, and Dante Fussell, congressman who was then the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, decided that they would create something called the National Endowment for Democracy. The Reagan administration took a different approach. They were looking to increase money for clandestine activities to help democracies, which was a contradiction in terms. Mm-hmm. And so I was very enthusiastic about the Don Frazier, Donnie Fussell approach, and that has become the National Endowment for Democracy. And it's supposed to be private, but uses government money. The private aspect of it is that they have a board that is made up of private individuals and some members of Congress as well. So this isn't, they're not dictated to by any particular administration. And they allocate money to both the Democratic Institute, which is affiliated loosely with the Democratic Party, and the Republican Institute. And so they work, they basically work with political parties mainly, even those who become part of a government. And they try to do the nuts and bolts of democracy, how a political party organizes democratically, how they communicate with constituents, how parliaments work. We're talking about countries that have never had a parliament. And so we don't try to export the American system, because the American system doesn't work in most places. And I mean, we started with some very big successes. We observed the election, the snap election in the Philippines, when Marcos decided that he would hold a snap election under some pressure. And of course, the People Power Revolution was one of the results when he tried to steal that election. And then we went on to Chile, where Pinochet decided he would have a plebiscite, and he thought he could control everything and win. We sent people down to register voters. We sent people down to help the opposition with its media and polling. And they ended up winning. And Pinochet was out of office. And then the wall came down. And we were all over Eastern and Central Europe. And so it was a very dramatic, very good way for me to keep in, even despite the fact that I'd been a presidential appointee in the Carter administration. For 12 years, the Democrats were out of power, and I was one of the few people that actually was able to stay involved in international affairs, representing a major institution, the Democratic Party of the United States. So when Clinton was elected, I was then asked to be the transition leader at the State Department and went on to eventually be the head of USAID. So,
but even going back even farther, in the early 80s, you were responsible for training all foreign service officers, right? As head of professional studies and academic affairs?
Right. Dean. They called me a dean.
The dean. Thinking about the intervening years and if you had that job today, how has diplomacy changed over the course of your career? And what would you say to students today that's different from what you might have been saying to them then?
I'm not sure how much I would change today, except that there are all sorts of new issues that come up that they need to have some understanding. I think that some of the threats that we see in the world today, like cyber warfare, require a diplomatic solution. We've got to have a better understanding, perhaps through the UN, as to what is permissible and what is not, and what would be the reaction of the international community if someone were to use cyber warfare to turn the lights out in a major economy, which would be a real problem. Then there are issues like, should we have, at the time they were negotiating whether or not we should demilitarize the Indian Ocean, should we demilitarize outer space? These are the kinds of things that I think people need to be thinking about. We, for example, were the first country that really developed the technology of drones, weaponized drones. I thought at the time that science is getting ahead of our ability to control it. And now we have other countries have drones and can attack that way. And I think it's just short-sighted on our part not to think ahead and to use diplomacy to try to get out ahead of these issues before they become problems for us.
Do you think you'd need to give Foreign Service officers a pep talk?
For sure. The expression that's used most often is that the State Department is being hollowed out, and it really has been. It's awful, the budget cuts, but more importantly, the kinds of controls over Foreign Service officers in terms of their ability to add to the discussion about what our policies ought to be. And so many people are leaving because they just are not respected. And I've always considered the Foreign Service to be the balance wheel in our political system.
Yeah, what does that mean? What do you mean by that? I've read that.
Well, I've been a political appointee 3 times, a presidential appointee, but I was also a career Foreign Service officer, and as you mentioned, Dean of Professional Studies for Foreign Service officers. These are the elite of the public service. People that can pass the Foreign Service exams and go in and be diplomats representing the country, they have institutional knowledge that people who are political appointees don't have. And so if political appointees are just open to hearing the professional advice of these people, we're going to be a lot better off. Every administration, whether it's a liberal one or a conservative one, comes in buying into the campaign promises of the candidate. And the campaign promises may get that candidate votes, but it doesn't necessarily make any sense once they become the president of the United States. I once gave a speech after the Carter administration when Ronald Reagan won, and I went through all of the promises he made, and I said, and I tried to be as even-handed as possible, that can he really do these things? And should he not consider these things? And that kind of thing. So the balance wheel is that we have to have professionals, people like Chaz Freeman, who's here, and Richard Boucher, myself, and there's a book that I use in my class on diplomacy by John Brady Keesling. He's someone who became quite senior. He was the political counselor in Greece, and it was his second tour in Greece. He spoke the language. He knew everyone. He could deal with the press. He could deal with academics and the like. And of course, it was during the invasion of Iraq, which he knew to be wrong. And he came to the point where he just couldn't defend the policy any longer, and he resigned and wrote a very thoughtful book about why he resigned. Now, that's an extreme. Their issue today is whether people should stay in and hope that they can have some influence, or do they leave? And a lot of them, unfortunately, are leaving.
Well, we'll be paying close attention to that situation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And another thing that's in the news that I can't avoid asking you about is there a place where humanitarian assistance and development and the coronavirus intersect?
Well, most people are missing this, but when the Ebola crisis hit, it was USAID that was the point agency on the ground. And I think that can be, again, not that the CDC is obviously extremely important from the U.S. point of view, but we have underfunded the CDC, we've underfunded USAID, and we've underfunded the World Health Organization. Those are the organizations, the institutions that should be on the front lines. And I really do think the Chinese made major mistakes in the early days. They should have invited the World Health Organization over very early. They didn't even want to hear the bad news initially. And that's part of the problem of an authoritarian government that thinks they can control the news. You can't control information, because then everybody becomes very suspicious, and it just exacerbates the problem.
This is a terrible question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Are you optimistic about American society and institutions?
No. I think that a lot of degradation has occurred in the last 3 years. And we're challenging the institutions that are supposed to make us a rule of law society. We're challenging the Congress and its rights. I mean, the other day, the court ruled that the Congress didn't have a right to subpoena a witness. And so congressional oversight and the balance, checks and balances have been undercut. The press itself is being attacked. I feel very pessimistic, and I know I believe this. I don't want to be political here, but I do think the next election is crucial in terms of maintaining our democracy. It's really under threat. And I'm not sure that, I think that a lot of people on both sides of the aisle know this. Some are silent and some are not.
Thank you for your candor. I just have one more question. I know you were a history major at Boston University.
Right.
What made you want to go into this career or this direction?
Well, everyone, I suppose, is inspired to do things like this by someone. And I grew up at the time of John F. Kennedy. And when you look back at history, you realize he was a human being too, and he had his faults, but he was an inspirational president.
And he died while you were in college, I
he
guess,
did.
If I do
he
the
did.
Math correctly.
That's exactly right. I was supposed to play football the day after he was killed in Fenway Park, the last time that Boston University played Boston College. And I was going to be starting, and it was all very exciting, and no one really felt like it, and the game was canceled. So I tell anyone here, the coach at Brown may want to know that I have one game of eligibility left if they want to use me.
What position?
End. I was an end.
Mm-hmm. But so it was JFK who inspired you to pursue this
absolutely
career?
Absolutely. I had no doubt. I can remember the first interview I had with a government agency, and they asked why I was interested in working for government. I said, I don't really feel as though I could dedicate my life to selling Colgate dental cream. I really had more in mind, and government was what I wanted to do. So.
And you certainly have.
Well, I got lucky, but then most important, I'm able now to be involved in academia. I became the dean of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, and now I'm here at the Watson Institute. I'm delighted to carry on what I hope is a public service career.
Well, we're delighted to have you here with all your expertise and experience. Thank you so much for coming and talking to us today. It's been a pleasure.
Delighted. Thank you, Sarah.
This episode was produced by Dan Richards and Jackson Cantrell. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. Additional music by the Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Sarah Baldwin. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll be bringing you more episodes soon on the coronavirus pandemic as it unfolds from our community of experts at Watson and Brown. For more information about Trending Globally and Watson's other podcasts, go to watson.brown.edu. Thanks for listening, and tune in soon for another episode of Trending Globally.